Okay, I'll call our third case for the day. Smith versus Clareman. Am I saying it correctly or not?
Clareman.
Say it again.
Clareman.
Thank you very much. 15-18-207. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Chief Justice Rogan-Sack, and may it please the Court. This case presents three issues, two of them closely related, all three of them related in a different way that I'll try to emphasize as we go along. First of all, whether a 50% member of a member-managed Wisconsin limited liability company owes a fiduciary duty to the other 50% member. That's the first issue. Secondly, whether a member of an LLC has standing to recover profits that are allegedly lost by the entity itself as an entity. And thirdly, and those are related because they're both about Chapter 183 of the statutes, which creates limited liability companies that didn't previously exist. And thirdly, what's the nature of the Circuit Court's gatekeeping rule under 90702, something that you all have had occasion to write about recently, at some length, which the legislature...
What was that length, counsel?
which the legislature adopted so as to import into Wisconsin law the federal standard under the Daubert case, or Daubert, I'm never sure which, governing the admissibility of expert testimony. So the first two are related because they both arise out of Chapter 183. The three are related because they all three have to do with legislative enactments superimposed into an area where courts have previously made the rules. And in a way, these issues all present the question of how do the courts properly respond to the fact that the legislature has spoken and made the law in an area in which it's competent to make the law. The first issue about fiduciary duties among equal LLC members requires a little bit of background. Now, this court in 2005 talked about LLCs in the Gottsacker case. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley wrote for the court. Justice Rogan-Sack, joined by Justice Wilcox, concurred. And I'm going to build on that, because what is an LLC? It's an organized business entity. It is, as a corporation is an organized business entity, or a limited liability partnership is a business entity. It's separate from an unorganized business entity, like a sole proprietorship or a partnership. Governed by Chapter 183, a law adopted in 1993, and the court went on in some length to tell about how originally this was in Wyoming, and they set up an LLC to get some tax advantage, and that's really what makes LLCs so attractive. Once it became clear that the IRS would allow them to be taxed as partnerships, even though they're not partnerships, even though they have limited liability, which, of course, partnerships don't. It's what makes them so attractive and why there are so many of them. Most new businesses now, not only in Wisconsin but throughout the country, are organized under the LLC framework rather than under the corporation framework.
What about law firms?
Please. Law firms tend to be LLPs, and I don't understand why. Some of them are LLCs, and of course some of them are.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, one of them is a partnership, and one of them is a limited liability company, and the differences that we'll be talking about today. Partnerships, certainly within a partnership, is the principle of fiduciary duties among partners. LLCs, not. That's the key difference.
That's what you want the court to say.
That's what we want the court to say.
It's not in the statute.
Well, that's right, and it's not in the statute. That's the point. The legislature didn't say that there would be fiduciary duties, and it's inconsistent with the whole setup of the statute, which was, as the court said in Gottsacker, set up to make a simple way of setting up a business. It didn't require much lawyer work. It didn't require articles. It didn't require a board of directors. Doesn't provide for officers. It's two, even one sometimes, but two people or more who decide to have a loosely organized business.
Well, they could have had an operating agreement, though, and still
could
be an LLC, and they could have said then different obligations of one member to another.
The statute, is quite clear that you can have an operating agreement. They didn't have one in the Gottsacker case, and there isn't one here. But you can have an operating agreement that would act like a normal articles and bylaws if you want to have one. Maximum flexibility. But you don't have to have one. And the question really that this case presents is, when you don't have one and you don't have an operating agreement that says we'll have fiduciary duties to each other, do you have them? And the reason that we say that the primary reason there aren't any is because the legislature didn't say to have them. And it would be inconsistent in many ways with the purpose of an LLC to imply and to impose on this structure that the legislature has created the requirement of fiduciary duties. And the principled reason behind that has to do with how fiduciary duties first were imposed in the more traditional, longstanding, couple hundred years back in England and the United States business organization called corporations. Corporations have shareholders, often many of whom are just investors, have nothing to do with the operation of the business. That's a what was the structure that was built up? The principle of agency is embodied in the operation of a corporation. That is, a board of directors is appointed, elected by the shareholders, and they act for the corporation. They have, and the courts have said, that they have a, going back a long time ago, they have a fiduciary duty to the corporation and to the shareholders. Why? Because they're in charge, and because they have voluntarily taken on the role that gives them fiduciary responsibilities.
Well, here, one of these men was a president, and the other one was what, executive vice president?
They gave each other those titles, but they didn't.
They had a right to do that, right?
Please?
They had a right to do
that. They had a right to call each other whatever they wanted, Your Honor.
Right.
And I don't mean to be flippant by that. There's no operating agreement that says one of them will be the person who signs deeds on behalf of the LLC or anything like that.
LLCs don't typically have presidents and...
No. There is no provision in the statute, Your Honor, for officers of LLCs or directors.
But somebody has to manage it, right?
No.
It says under subsection 13, manager.
You can have managers.
Okay.
This one doesn't. You have one of the basic choices you have with an LLC is you can decide to have a manager or you can decide to be member managed. That is, the members themselves will manage. Most of them are. This one was.
This one is
a member-managed LLC.
Okay, so you got two members, and they're both going to manage it, right?
Right. And under the principles of an LLC, the act of either one can bind the LLC. It's also clear that neither one, because the statute says this in 183.03.01, I think, that neither one is the agent of the other. So this notion of where fiduciary duties come from in corporations, in partnerships, stems from the fact that the partners, the directors, are agents for the other, because the notion of fiduciary duty comes from a voluntary assumption of an agency relationship as one does when one becomes a director and as one does not when one becomes a member of an LLC. It's a very important principle. And if you get back to, you think about the typical, your court has talked about this in the Zastro case, the typical situation in which there's a fiduciary relationship is one of a voluntary assumption of it. One agrees to be a trustee for the benefit of somebody else. One agrees to become a director for the benefit of shareholders. One agrees to become an agent for the benefit of a principal. It's voluntary. And why is that important? Because it has really important responsibilities. One that, again, in my view, fully inconsistent with the whole concept of an LLC, and that is a fiduciary has to put aside the fiduciary's own interest and act in the interest of the one being for which one is a fiduciary. You have to favor the shareholders over the director's own interest. You have to favor the beneficiary over the trustee's own interest.
Well, 183.0107.3 says that anybody, any member can execute, person executing signs it. But then 3 says the person executing the document may do so as an attorney in fact. You don't have to have a power of attorney. So I thought attorneys, in fact, have obligations to all the other people.
Your Honor, could you repeat the statute you're talking about? That wasn't what I had in mind.
183.0107.
Okay.
Execution of documents.
Yes.
And then it's subsection 3.
That doesn't, I think, have anything to do with members, Your Honor. All it says
it seems to me, that you only have 2 people in this entity.
Right.
You don't have any managers. So
right.
One of them is going to execute a document, all right? Any document, 1R says any document required or permitted shall be executed by a manager if management is vested in the manager, or any member if management is reserved to the members. So I'm assuming management here is reserved to the members.
It is.
Okay. So a person, one of the members executing the document, may do so as an attorney in fact, which makes that person, in the next sentence, his powers of attorney don't have to be shown or filed.
An attorney, in fact, for whom, Justice Abrahamson, so I understand your question. Is it for LLC or for the other member?
The member.
I think, with respect, you're misreading that subsection, Your Honor. What it says is that someone who is executing as a member or manager, someone else may execute it as an attorney in fact. And the powers of attorney to the execution of the document do not need to be shown or filed with the department.
Well, if you look at 1R, it says that it has to be a member. And we agreed, you just said that the powers of management are in the members.
That's a document required to be delivered for filing to the department
right.
of financial institutions. It has nothing to do with this.
You don't think it's broader than that, huh?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
All right.
I think that's inconsistent with the notion that the LLC itself can be bound by the act of a single member if it's a member-managed LLC. So, and to me, that's the fundamental difference. This fiduciary responsibility, when it exists, is that selflessness that one doesn't associate with people doing business with each other, unless one has delegated to that other a responsibility to act that is different from what exists in an LLC.
Don't you also have to accept a responsibility as a fiduciary? It can't be, I'm going to delegate it to you. You have to accept it. It isn't a one-way street.
Without question. If I could become a trustee and put my assets at risk because someone has decided to name me as a trustee for his or her benefit, that would be an awful concept. And it doesn't exist in the LLC context at all.
Well, you say without a question. I guess there are lots of other jurisdictions that think there's a question.
There are some.
Executive Center, the case that
right.
was decided in 2011, indicates, in fact, there's a growing consensus that common law fiduciary duties should apply to the operation of LLCs, and it has a laundry list of cases from around the country. So there's a question of whether
Let me respond to that. That, of course, is the decision which we pay attention to at all because it gets published, of a single trial judge in Milwaukee operating in a federal court in a diversity case, supposedly applying Wisconsin law, to which he looks to the rulings of this court, and there weren't any. He makes that point at the beginning. He's engaging in what's referred to as the eerie guess of what the Wisconsin law would be.
Well, let me focus on what I just read, however.
Right.
And that is, he says there's a growing consensus. I'm not talking about what the Wisconsin court said or didn't say in the Gottschalker case. There's a growing consensus that common law fiduciary duties should apply to the operation of LLCs. And he cites Indiana. He cites just a number of jurisdictions, Kentucky, California. I mean, it's a couple of...
There are cases, Your Honor, in which the legislature has imposed fiduciary duties among members of an LLC. There are cases in which the legislature has been silent, in which courts have imposed those fiduciary duties. Some of those were cited by Judge Stadtmiller in those opinions. There are others. We cited the decision of the Virginia Supreme Court in one of the cases where they said, no, that's for the legislature to decide, pointing out that the legislature had imposed fiduciary duties on partnerships and hadn't done it on LLCs. The same situation as in
My
Wisconsin.
My question was different than Justice Bradley's. And just so I know that I have it on the table for you all to consider, even if you were to impose a common law fiduciary duty, it either has to be written in the statute and you accept it by taking what the statute says, or you have to accept that duty affirmatively by word or conduct, correct?
Well,
I couldn't find a case where any court imposed a fiduciary duty that either by word or conduct, the person who became the fiduciary didn't accept the duty.
I don't know of any, Your Honor. My friend may think differently. He's arguing that you ought to adopt fiduciary duties and read them into the statute,
well,
even though it's not there.
I'm talking about the common law premise. The common law premise has two parts.
Right.
It doesn't have you just get it because I want you to have it. You get it because either by your conduct or your words you have accepted that responsibility.
I don't want to argue your point because you may be right. I just hadn't thought
Does
about it.
Does that apply to Chapter 182 then?
180
also? 180
also?
Yes.
No, because Chapter 80 was enacted against the background of recognized fiduciary duties of directors and officers toward shareholders and toward the corporation. And so that had such a long common law history at the time the Wisconsin Business Corporations Law was adopted that it's recognized and discussed in the statute.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. That premise in terms of Wisconsin, I think when it comes to fiduciary duties vis-a-vis Chapter 180, has been, and I quote, resistant to codification, unquote, from an article from Ken Davis not too long ago.
Yeah. Well, let me just make one other point about corporations. Shareholders of the corporation don't owe each other fiduciary duties. That's the clear law of Wisconsin. Judge Brown had a decision on that some years ago. And that's correct. And for the same reason. 50-50 shareholders don't owe each other fiduciary obligations because they haven't undertaken it voluntarily. They aren't acting as agents of the others. And so to me that's it. Let me just say one other thing about Judge Stadtmiller's decision. He was not talking about duties between members of the corporation. He was talking about duties toward creditors because they're the company that failed. That's not this situation. He himself distinguished Justice Rogensack's concurrence in Gottschalker, not only on the ground that it wasn't the majority opinion, but that it didn't involve an inter se relationship that it did, and his case wasn't one.
This is an area that's of interest to me, and that is the question of what survives in 183 of the common law fiduciary duties those leading corporate entities. And I don't really know the answer. 183 took a little bit from partnership, took a little bit from 180, and put them all together and you spell 183. And the question is, for me, how much of what they took from 180, which clearly, in my mind, has common law is
underpinnings.
Underpinnings. I mean, since, you know, for decades upon decades upon decades upon decades, Davis cites a 1929 decision from Marvin Rosenberry and quotes from it where he sets out for prior to 1929 all of the cases that had this. So there's no doubt about it. My question is, how do we know? And I ask for help in this.
Well,
how do we know when we took part from 180, we didn't take that underpinnings with it?
Part of it is that Chapter 180 talks about fiduciary duties. And Chapter 183 doesn't. Indeed, and the partnership law talks about fiduciary duties, and Chapter 183 doesn't.
But, see, my question is premised on that there are fiduciary duties in case law that are not mentioned in the statute that are still alive and well and vibrant. Made that Wisconsin has been resistant to codifying fiduciary duties in the statute, that we've been comfortable in having this evolve over decades vis-a-vis case law.
Well, with all due respect to Dean Davis, that's his reading of it. He's looked back, and again, clearly the development of fiduciary duties for corporations go back more than decades. It goes back into the 19th century and probably the 18th. But that's the background against which the business corporation law was codified whenever it was, 91. And yeah, that's the background against which the legislature acted, decided not to codify the fiduciary duties that already were present in the law, also didn't wipe them out. It recognized that they existed. That's the difference here. With LLCs, you've got this simple, you file it, and off you go.
Is the fiduciary a kind of agent?
Is it what?
Is it a type of agent?
It is. It's based on a concept of agency.
Well, in 183.0301 says that one member is not the agent of the other member.
We try to develop that in our brief. It's the principle that is inconsistent with the existence of fiduciary responsibilities among LLC members. Let me just take a second. I'm going to skip over the derivative claim.
If you're finished, fine, before
yes.
you go into something else. The Court of Appeals said that there was an instruction, I'm reading from paragraph 26, and that you didn't object. I don't know if you were trial counsel.
No.
But you didn't, trial counsel didn't object to this instruction. The instruction was fiduciary position, and it's gone.
Well, there's a reason I think why my friend didn't argue this to the Court of Appeals as a basis for fiduciary duty here. That instruction
at the trial court.
That instruction talked about the fiduciary duty that an employee has to the corporation.
It was an officer.
Right. An officer has as an employee, if you read the instruction. And that's because at the time that that instruction was agreed to, there was a claim brought purportedly on behalf of the LLC against Mr. Kleinerman on behalf of the LLC for breach of fiduciary duty to the LLC. That dropped out of the case and didn't go to the jury.
Well, then are they wrong saying that this was an instruction as an officer?
They read the instruction wrong, and
that's your answer.
Well, the instruction says that an officer of a corporation owes a fiduciary duty to the corporation. This isn't the corporation.
Well, it said as an officer with act. So,
well,
that's what it said.
That's what it says.
Act is LLC.
Yes.
So that's what I have to read.
Well, that is not a basis for the imposition of fiduciary duty.
Well, there was an instruction.
Right.
There was no objection. The court said there was a waiver.
The claim here is by a member. It's not by the LLC.
I'm just telling you what that says. You don't think that's right, then?
I don't think that's correct. I think
you don't think it was waived.
And I think the fact that Smith didn't raise that in the Court of Appeals is pretty clear.
Okay. Now
let me say
another question.
Okay.
Unless you have another answer.
No. I want to talk about 907 a bit, but whatever Your Honor wants to say.
I'm looking at 183.0304. It's entitled Liability of Members to Third Parties. But subsection 2 doesn't limit it that way. It says, notwithstanding 1, nothing in this chapter, whole chapter of 183, shall preclude a court from ignoring the limited liability company entity under principles of common law of the state similar to those of business corporations and shareholders. and under circumstances not inconsistent with the purposes of the chapter. What does that mean?
Well, I think it is the fact that it relates to liabilities to members of third parties.
Well, but it doesn't
comes
say
not
that.
Only from the title, but from the beginning of 02, it says notwithstanding sub 1. It's on the same subject.
That's right, but it says nothing in the chapter. So it goes
nothing
much.
In the chapter precludes the court from finding that the LLC can have a fiduciary duty to a third party, can have duties under the common law, under principles of common law, to third parties. I think that's the executive center case. That's Judge Statmiller's case.
Not limited to that.
Okay, I just wanted to say one thing, because my time is about to expire, and not 90702, which you talked about last week at some length, is implicated in this case.
Oh, this is the Daubert one.
Issue. Because in this case, the plaintiff's expert got on the witness stand, gave an entirely different opinion than he'd given in the report. I came up with a $449 to $489 million or $1,000 damages claim for lost profits, where he had previously said $175. And I'll sit down. And my time has expired.
Okay, very good. Thank
okay,
you.
But I'd like you to talk about Daubert when you come back.
Counsel, as you begin, what's your best argument about why the other member owed a fiduciary duty to your member, not to the LLC, but to your member?
Excuse me. May it please the Court. Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Kramer of the firm Hanson Reynolds, LLC. I have the honor of representing Scott Smith, who's present here in the front row behind me. I also would like to acknowledge Daniel Nardick, my colleague who was essential to the briefing in this case. My best argument for why Mr. Kleinerman had a fiduciary duty directly to Scott Smith.
To Mr. Smith, exactly.
My best argument is that on the narrowest grounds that you could affirm the Court of Appeals, the jury instruction that we've been talking about, the jury instruction was agreed to in the trial court, and the jury instruction was agreed to and went to the jury even after any derivative claims were dismissed out of this case. So that argument I don't think holds up. This is something that was completely agreed to, never objected to, and in fact it was jointly drafted by the parties in this case and was
okay. Well, what principles of law would you rely on? The jury instruction, I understand what your argument is. It's well set out in your brief.
What is the point? Is it waived because there wasn't no objection?
The point is that they have waived an argument that there doesn't exist a duty under that obligation.
Right.
That's an established fact at trial because it was an agreement.
I understand that. I get that. I want to know what principles of law, affirmative principles of law, is there that would support a fiduciary obligation from Mr. Kleinerman to Mr. Smith?
Under the jury instruction, I know why you're trying to push me in that direction, but under the jury instruction, Mr. Kleinerman was an officer. He was an officer. Now, the LLC statute doesn't necessarily establish the officer
position. Well, your client was an officer, too. In the complaint, it says he was the president.
That's correct.
Okay, so they both were officers. They called each other officers.
As officers.
Okay.
They've imported into their LLC, by their agreement, corporate principles. And as officers of the LLC, they owe the corresponding fiduciary duties of officers to the, there aren't shareholders in the LLC, but there are members, they're the owners. So each officer, by having voluntarily assumed that title and those duties, they then become fiduciaries to the other members because the members stand in the place of the shareholders.
How do you get that argument to fit within 183.03.01, which says they are not the agents of one another?
The LLC statute provides for maximum flexibility, and they may not be agents under the statutory scheme, but because they have chosen in the context of their LLC to establish these executive officer positions, they have established the duties that correspond with those in the corporate context.
Was there an election for these office positions?
There was not. It was by agreement.
Mr. Smith had the higher office, right? He was the president.
He was the president.
Anything else you can tell me about why you think there's a fiduciary duty directly from Mr. Kleinman to Mr. Smith?
Yes. The second reason why there was a fiduciary duty directly from Mr. Kleinman to Mr. Smith is that in the documents that were executed, the memorandum of understanding prior to moving into the transaction that we're mostly
the one that you
about.
Did March of 2009, is that the one
correct.
You
got?
Gotcha. Okay.
It set forth and gave Mr. Kleinman power of attorney type powers to execute documents and transfer assets. Beyond, so Mr. Kleinman already had that duty had that ability as a member of the LLC. It gave him additional powers to act on behalf of Mr. Smith. And in doing so, Mr. Kleinman came to stand in the position of a power of attorney.
For the opportunity to assign the things that are covered in the MOU, but my understanding is you've gone beyond. When you're talking about fiduciary duty, you're talking about a breach of a duty that you seem to think is beyond the term of the MOU. You haven't complained that the MOU wasn't complied with or there was no right to assign these patents, right? And, in fact, Mr. Smith signed the document.
That's here, correct. So. In addition to the MOU, that's one piece of this, that there was a power of attorney position that Mr. Kleinman voluntarily assumed to Mr. Smith. In addition to that, there are numerous facts that were established at trial regarding Mr. Smith's mental state at the time of this transaction. He was in a state of deep grief.
His wife unfortunately died in 2007, and I can understand why that would make him very, very sad. But this transaction went down in March of 2009.
And the facts established at trial showed that the grief was not just what you might term ordinary grief. It affected him in a very specific and very all-encompassing way. He suffered from severe depression at the time of this transaction.
Did he hire an attorney to help look over the MOU for him and the transactions that were attendant to it?
Did he hire an attorney to represent his interest in the MOU?
Yeah, to look him over, sure.
No, he did not, because he was assured by Mr. Kleinman that he did not need an attorney for those purposes. No.
Counsel, when I look at the claims that were alleged by your client in the complaint, with the exception of one, they're all generally common law causes of action. And I understand you were not trial counsel, but do you have any understanding as to why Mr. Smith did not bring any claims directly under Chapter 183?
I don't have an understanding of that, no. But I believe that the complaint sufficiently sets forth allegations that were then proved up at trial that meet with a violation of Chapter 183.0402 duties that members do owe to each other. And specifically, the 183.0402 duty, if one member has a conflict of interest, they have a duty to deal fairly with the other member under that statute. And in this case, Mr. Kleinman clearly had a conflict of interest. He had a conflict of interest. He had an undisclosed interest in the new business, red flag. He had loans and other business advice that he received from Mr. Glazer.
If that general duty of good faith and fair dealing, if that claim could be read to be one under Chapter 183, what happened to that claim at trial?
I believe that the 183.0402 claim is encompassed in a general breach of fiduciary duty claim that was made at trial.
So you're asking us to read into that provision of Chapter 183 of fiduciary duty. You're trying to tie it to that statutory language?
And I think the reason it's less than what are the common law fiduciary duties, certainly.
Say that again. It's less than what?
The Chapter 183.0402 duties are somewhat less than what are traditional common law fiduciary duties. But they do state fiduciary duties. And going back to the similar, very same language, essentially, swapping out corporate versus LLCs in Data Key Partners, this court called those same duties fiduciary duties. in the context of Data Key Partners, excuse me, the discussion was these duties are what a director could still be held liable for under the business judgment rule. And those were called fiduciary duties in that context. And correspondingly, those are fiduciary duties in the context of the limited liability company.
What about sub C?
About
sub C, a transaction from which the member derived an improper personal profit?
Absolutely, and I think that to the same extent, Mr. Kleinerman derived an improper personal profit to the extent that he took away all the opportunities that Mr. Smith had in the in ACT. He comes away with a much larger ownership stake, the opportunity to continue in the same business with additional capital and production facilities.
How is it that any injury that you're complaining of is not really derivative of the injury to ACT? That's who owned all the patents. It wasn't either of these members. How is it that this injury that you talk about for lost profits isn't lost profits for ACT?
In the Gottsacker case, this court described a member's interest in a limited liability as personal property. And in addition, there is a right to receive a share of profits and losses and a right to vote or participate in the management of the LLC. And those come from Chapter 183.0703 and 183.0102, subsection 11, I believe. And because Mr. Smith was deprived of those personal rights that he had, this is a personal claim. This is a direct claim versus derivative.
Right, but the profits that are lost are profits to the ACT. They're not profits to him. He didn't own the patents that were at issue here, and from which apparently some profit was made by a successor corporation. So I don't see why there isn't what you're talking about is not a derivative claim.
In the context of a 50-50 LLC, I think the distinction is one that is not necessary to make. Essentially, when one member
Section in here about the right to sue on behalf of a limited liability company. So the legislature thought it was important that you follow some particular thing if you're going to be claiming an injury to the LLC, right? I mean, that's what the statute says. I don't know.
But here the injury is not to the LLC. It's to Mr. Smith personally.
How did he have a right to profits? What you're claiming.
He had a right to receive a share of the profits of...
Right, but only if the LLC first had a right to the profits. He can't get them on his own. He doesn't have any interest in the patents on his own. He has to get his interest from the LLC. I mean, where is his interest that's independent for profits?
In the context of the LLC, Mr. Smith and Mr. Kleinerman were affected differently. Mr. Smith was affected in the sense that he was left with nothing. He comes away with this transaction with literally nothing to show for it. Right. He received no money. He received no other consideration, even the dollar that was supposed to have been paid.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with your facts at all. My concern is really a legal one, and I'm not quite sure how you get around 183.1101, given what you're seeking is lost profits. You were seeking something else, I might feel differently about it. But lost profits were lost profits for the LLC. He didn't have any right to profits at all except whatever share of the LLC was paid out. He'd be taxed on all of it, I guess, because it's a partnership deal. Taxation-wise.
Sure. To the extent that Mr. Smith was affected in an entirely different way than Mr. Kleinerman, I think that this becomes a direct suit. Now, the traditional distinctions between direct and derivative sort of break down in this context because one member derives an improper personal profit or benefits to his great benefit and the direct detriment of another member of an LLC. I think the fact that Mr. Smith was so directly and personally done wrong, while at the same time Mr. Kleinerman, the other 50-50 member, was advantage to such a great degree provided a direct claim by Mr. Smith on behalf of his share. And he's not asking for all of it. He's just asking for his share.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Turning to, I think, the additional issue related to the admission of the expert opinion. In this case, the expert provided an opinion that was essentially a model of the lost profits, and not just lost profits, but the share of Mr. Smith's share of the lost profits that could be expected. And what changed at trial was not the way he calculated or came up with any of those, his opinion. What changed at trial was he was provided with additional information that allowed him to update and bring his calculation under those same circumstances forward to the present. And the fact that the number changed is, I don't think, any problem or any reason why.
Well, you can attack that at cross-examination.
Absolutely, and that was attacked on cross-examination,
but
vigorously.
Are you familiar with the Sievert case?
Yes.
All right. So how do you apply that case to this case?
Well, I think the Sievert case at the trial level was a model for how to do this. There.
Well answered.
They had.
I don't think it's a model at this point.
There was.
I'll go along with that.
I'm sorry.
I said I'll agree with you on that.
Okay, thank you.
Right, let's talk about what was or wasn't done at the trial court.
So in this case in particular, there was no pretrial motion regarding the expert's admissibility.
It's not required, but it's better.
It's not required, but the fact that this expert's opinion didn't actually change other than the number. So what the difference was math. It boils down to a mathematical calculation. It wasn't challenged pretrial, and it was barely stated at trial. It was at the end of cross-examination. It was off the record, I believe in the judge's chambers, or off the record at the very least. And it was merely, I don't believe this meets the proper criteria. There's no explanation of what specifically was wrong with the expert opinion. It was very short and un... I'm sorry?
Go ahead. Well, short and un what?
It was short, and it was unexpanded upon to any degree to allow the judge to either form an opinion about what the objection actually was, what it was going to. And in the heat of a trial, they were trying to get to the next witness, and because it was a belated objection, the judge is under no obligation to either sua sponte challenge an expert's testimony or to sit there and recite the Daubert standard and go through a detailed analysis just because that particular objection is raised at that point in time. Now, if there's a pretrial Daubert motion and this is properly raised, I think that that's a valid point and they could have explored that, but it wasn't. And it was too late and too vague.
Counselor, are you done?
Let's suppose that the expert doesn't fit under Daubert. Is that harmless error here?
If the expert doesn't fit under Daubert?
Mm-hmm. And that's what's being claimed here. Testimony of Smith's expert was not based on reliable methodologies.
Again, the methodology utilized was math. He made some calculations and he added up to a new total. And the fact that it wasn't challenged pre-trial, I think, operates as a waiver of any challenge later to the actual assumptions or calculations, the way that these things were calculated. The only change, and the only thing they can point to, is a change in the actual number. It got bigger because new sales figures were brought forward.
Can you tell me where the breaches of this fiduciary duty that you allege was present occurred?
The breaches occurred with a lack of loyalty, essentially.
What was the date? When are you talking about?
I'm sorry?
When did that occur and where?
When did it occur? It was...
I have to have it tied to something. That's what I'm
looking for. Sure, understood. It was a continuing breach of candor and loyalty, essentially. At the time these parties were engaging in the transaction, Mr. Smith and I hate to keep going back to it, but he wasn't in a very depressed state. He was not fully functioning. Now, that plays into it in the sense that Mr. Kleinerman engineered a transaction, and he had clear conflicts of interest, material conflicts of interest, in that he was dealing with people who had loaned him money, people who had interest in his other businesses, people who were paying him a salary separate from the ACT LLC, and he had a larger plan to eventually become the majority owner of the LLC, the majority member of that LLC, and in fact he did. It was consummated when Mr. Kleinerman became the 75% owner or member.
Didn't his ownership become weighted with the hundreds of thousands of dollars that the other people had put in order to keep this idea of selling these seals viable?
Mr. Kleinerman's interest, according to my understanding of what happened, was for a nominal value. He took over Mr. Glazer's interest. Mr. Glazer still was owed all of that money as a loan.
Right. So any profits that the LLC made, that would have to go back first to paying back this debt, right? I mean, that's how I understood the transaction. He paid a nominal amount for it, but he agreed that this was a viable debt for the LLC and its business going forward.
That's my understanding as well, yes.
Okay, thank you.
If the court should hold against you and adopt your opponent's argument, do we have to overrule the Gottsacker case? Because Mr. Schreiner asking us really to adopt the Rogensack concurring opinion?
I believe, yes, he is asking the court to adopt that opinion. I don't know that Gottsacker got to the issue necessarily of the fiduciary duties owed between members, but to the extent that the actual duties, the 183.04.02 duties, are implicated here, it would call into question to some degree. If you're going to say that what Mr. Kleinerman did here was not a breach of those duties, that he had a material conflict of interest and he didn't deal fairly with Mr. Smith, which I think is very clear, and you can find that from the record that the circuit court built, that it calls into question the court's holding in Gottsacker in that way, because in that case, you sent it back for a finding regarding whether there was a fair dealing between the members. But
right, the issue wasn't breached in Gottsacker that we're asked to talk about today, are we?
Not exactly, no. It set out that duty exists, but it didn't.
So that would have to be withdrawn or whatever you want to do. Can't just accept Gottsacker without doing something to it.
I don't think we ever.
It would have to be expanded.
Yeah.
Or actually cut back to
that's
some degree.
That's what I'm asking.
Right,
you.
Yes. It would have to be cut back to some degree.
What in Gottsacker do you think would have to be changed from the majority opinion if we were to buy opposing counsel's argument?
In Gottsacker,
right,
there appeared to be an acceptance that an individual member can make a claim under 183.04.02 and have standing to make that claim, and that there are duties that members owe to each other that can be enforced. Now, if you're saying that the duties don't exist between the members of an LLC in this particular case, I think
it's just the fiduciary duty that we're talking about.
Right, fiduciary duties, but members are going to be left without any real redress for wrongs that are intra LLC, especially in the circumstance where you're saying if there's no standing to pursue a direct action for an individual member, then members are without redress. And the way I like to think about LLCs is they're corporations to the outside and partnerships to the inside. They sort of operate in that way, especially 50% LLCs. You know, it's two people. They're working together. I think that the fiduciary duties that apply in the context of a partnership should be what are applied in that circumstance. I think that makes a lot more sense and it would make LLCs more attractive.
There was a member agreement in the Gottsacker case, and that's one of the focuses of how we decided what we should look at for their obligations to one another, correct?
I don't recall exactly. I didn't believe there was a membership.
Said the issues presented here involve matters of contractual and statutory interpretation. We will initially examine the members' agreement to determine whether the petitioners possess the majority necessary to authorize the transfer.
I don't believe there's an operating agreement. I think it was a
membership agreement.
Set forth the there was a 50% and then a collective 50% between the two brothers, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I don't know that that was an operating agreement to the extent.
No, it's just a member agreement.
A member agreement.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist in this case, certainly.
Okay.
So going beyond the...
Let me ask, what implication, you cite another statute, what statute is it? I think it is 183.1202, approval of merger, sub 2. The manager or managers of a limited liability company may not approve a merger without obtaining the approval of the limited liability company members under sub 1. I thought you cited that, and if you did, what import does it have? Maybe you didn't cite it. I might have my notes wrong.
I don't believe that that was something that we relied upon
in
our brief, but I
didn't see it either.
And just based on your reading of that statute, I don't have it in front of me at this second. But.
Well, that's why I asked the question. I had that you did cite it, and I just couldn't figure out it. So.
Yeah, I don't believe that's something that we relied upon in our briefing. And if it is, it would have been a typo.
This wasn't a merger, then.
No, it wasn't a merger. That's what Mr. Smith thought it was, but it was not.
It was kind of like a bulk sales transaction that is done often where you just sell the assets of one company to the other company without assuming the liabilities of the first company.
Right, and that's what it ended up being, but that's not what Mr. Smith thought. And that goes back to issues that were litigated at the trial level, that there were, to our side, there were material misrepresentations regarding what exactly was occurring here.
Was there a finding made at the circuit court that he was incompetent and it was his incompetency that Mr. Klein took advantage of?
There was a finding on the claim of rescission based on incompetence that the jury did not agree that he was incompetent.
So
there was no finding of fact at the circuit court level that he was incompetent, but the facts remain that Mr. Smith was suffering very much at the time of this
Thank
transaction.
You.
In sum, I'd like to talk just a little bit about the LLC as it continues to go forward. I think there are some concerns that the way Mr. Klein would ask this court to rule about the fiduciary duties of members within an LLC is certainly different than what courts across the country have been doing. The Executive Center case, I think, lays out pretty clearly that numerous other states have started to adapt and adopt fiduciary duties between members inside of an LLC, and I think that that's the wise course of action.
Before you sit down, I mean, I remember looking at the Missouri case of sometime within the last year, and they held no fiduciary duty. It was my understanding that they held no fiduciary duty vis-a-vis third-party creditors, but there was an existence of fiduciary duty between members. Your opposing counsel, when I started to read part of the laundry list of the cases setting forth what Executive Center said was the national trend, offered that they could be distinguished because they were third-party creditors cases. Do you agree with that?
Executive Center was a third-party creditor.
No, I'm talking about the litany. There's a growing consensus that common law fiduciary duties should apply to the operations of LLCs. Now, that heading doesn't say with regard to creditors or with regard to members. It's just a broad heading. And then it has this laundry list of cases, which I confess I have not read, and I'm asking you if those cases are distinguishable because they are third parties as opposed to members.
Again, there's a lot there. There are a number of cases. I don't have them all memorized, but I know that at least in Indiana and Ohio, there have been adoptions by those courts in those jurisdictions that there are between members of LLCs fiduciary duties that have been implied. Loyalty and I think candor are the main fiduciary duties that they've adopted.
The very first case that was cited in this, what I refer to as a laundry list, is an Indiana case, 2002, and it's with a parenthesis, Indiana LLCs being similar to partnerships and corporations impose a common law fiduciary duty on their officers and members in the absence of contrary provisions in the LLC's operating agreement. So, again, that doesn't, from what I read, doesn't in any way distinguish it between members and creditors. In fact, it seems to say on members, a fiduciary duty on their officers and members in the absence of language to the contrary in the operating.
Right. I don't think those. There may be certain cases that are cited within the context of the Executive Center case that are specific to third-party duties, but in the broad national trend, it is not limited to third parties.
You mentioned Ohio. It doesn't Ohio impose it by statute?
I think yes. So that's part of the I suppose way that some of those cases can be distinguished. There are some that establish those duties statutorily, and some that have been adopted by adopting common law fiduciary duties between the duties that exist in the corporate context and also the partnership context. My red light is on. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Let me begin by saying, Justice Ann Bradley, if your notes reflect that I said all of those cases were third-party cases, I didn't mean to say that. I don't know. I think some of them are. I think others are not. I think there are some state Supreme Courts that have read an inter-member fiduciary duty into statutes that don't say it. There are also legislatures that have required it. Mm-hmm. Delaware was an example. For example, we looked at Delaware sometimes, where the statute was ambiguous, and the Delaware Supreme Court said, well, we'll give the legislature a chance to see whether or not it wants to impose such duties, and the legislature did.
Yes.
And then there's Virginia, which said, no, it isn't in there, and we're not going to impose it in the absence of legislative direction. And that's us, I think. And they pointed to the fact that the legislature had passed partnership law that had it and the LLC law that didn't have it. So some of these, I think, are simply, you know, you can look at things and see a trend, you know. You look at other things and see a trend. To some extent, it has to do with how some other courts see their relationship with the legislature of their states and who's in charge, to be frank. I don't think that the absence of any mention of fiduciary duties to members is an invitation to the court to create them. To me, that's sort of what you said at in Crown Castle a few years ago with respect to supplementary receivers. Silence is not an invitation to walk in and create law.
Can you tell me why 183.04.02 is not the same as fiduciary duties?
That's the one that talks about conflicted transactions.
Yep.
Yeah, among other things. I mean, it's not just that limited.
Well, it's 183.04.02 says that if you've got a conflicted transaction, and this was the Gottsacker case, and that's why this court sent the Gottsacker case back down to look into whether or not there had been unfair dealing. I don't think that goes to fiduciary duties. It might include fiduciary duties. It might not. But that's really not the focus of it.
In Data Key Partners, this court characterized those types of duties as laid out in the corporation statute as fiduciary
right.
in nature. Do you think the court was incorrect to characterize
No, I don't think
way?
It was, because the corporation does, again, there is a fiduciary duty that directors have toward shareholders. It's a different setup. And again, it's directors. It's not shareholders. Shareholders, again, we've got this case, the longstanding law in Wisconsin. Even 50-50 shareholders don't owe a fiduciary duty to each other. There's your analogy, if you want one.
So the particular duties that are laid out in these respective
right.
chapters, corporations and
right.
LLCs, the language is very similar. There's a general duty to deal fairly, and then it gets into more specific. Are you saying that that could be a fiduciary in nature with respect to officers and directors under the corporate context, but it's not fiduciary in nature with respect to members of an LLC?
It doesn't. You don't have to look at it as fiduciary in nature in order to carry it out. It could be. I mean, but remember, it's in relation to a particular transaction. The transaction here was the MOU and the related transactions, both of which Mr. Smith signed on to and Mr. Kleineman both signed on to. Talk about what this case was tried at. This case was tried. You don't have another remedy. This case was tried as a claim by ACT, shouldn't have been able to bring it, against Red Flag for rescission on the ground of Mr. Smith's incompetency. That's the setting in which the jury found that he wasn't incompetent. So this is a problem with a sort of an unvariegated, unfocused breach of fiduciary duty claim. It sounds to a jury like, well, they weren't nice. That's not breach of fiduciary duty. People in business with each other do not have to look out for the other party's interest above their own, which is the essence of a fiduciary duty.
When they're competitors, that's true. Not necessarily totally true, but not when they're officers of an entity.
Well, but they're not officers. In fact, they called each other president. They didn't amend the operating agreement to create offices. They didn't have an operating agreement to create offices. There aren't any offices in this LLC.
Is the business judgment rule codified in 183?
Yes. My friend Chester, who studied a lot more than I did, tells me yes. So I will answer that question based on it. I want to talk very briefly, probably because I promised Justice Abrahamson I will, about 90702. And all I want to say about 90702 is this. After this expert had been on the stand and had been cross-examined and come up with a new opinion that he hadn't had before, the jury was sent out. This wasn't done off the record. It's on the record. You can read it starting on page 289 of the appendix. And Mr. Bykofsky, for Mr. Kleineman, said, based on Mr. Rodriguez's testimony, I have concerns whether proper accounting methodology has been applied in his calculations. And then continuing on over to 291-92, I'm challenging the fact that he's applying acceptable principles and methodology. That's Daubert language. Talk about the case you decided last week. Judge Day tried that case well, in my view. I've read all your opinions. He knew what was going on there, and, of course, expert opinion is much more simple in the Med-Mal case. This was a case with several different claims being brought, two of which the jury rejected, where there had been a breach of fiduciary duty claim brought by ACT against Kleineman, which was dismissed and didn't go to trial, explaining why that jury instruction was in there. And that's the context in which this arose. And Judge Clone says in this, if you want to object to what he testified, I gave you an opportunity to cross-examine. You have another expert who's going to testify. That's a fair engagement of counter-views, 292. That's fine, but there's nothing for the court to do. Well, he's wrong. I mean, every one of your opinions that I read last week tells me he was wrong in saying this. This was 3.5 years after the legislature had adopted 90702. And when somebody stands up and says, I want to object because he's not applying acceptable principles and methodology, to have the judge say, in the way of the old days, that's for the jury to decide, which the Court of Appeals picked up on. You know, that goes to the weight of the evidence. That's not reliability. It's not Daubert. It's just wrong.
We can, thank you very much. Wrong, but we can get better rationale if the result is right. But the real question is, suppose you're right, Mr. Schreiner, about the Daubert.
Right.
Is that dispositive? Why would you win the whole lawsuit on
that? Because they didn't prove any damages.
Pardon me?
Because that's the only evidence they had of any damages in this case. Period.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for a very, very good argument. Very spirited oralists, both of you. And I enjoyed the briefs particularly because this is an area that I really find fascinating. It's always interesting to see how it's presented, and every case is a little bit different. So thank you very much. We will adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. Thank you.